Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Everyone is Addicted. Today's guest, David, has graciously come on to share his knowledge and his experience with addiction. So, welcome, David. It's really nice to have you on and nice to meet you. Thank you for coming on and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, my name is David. I'm originally from Detroit, Michigan. It's been many years since I've been there, but that's where I started, and that's where I fell apart, and that's where I ended up in a lot of trouble. I was born with birth defects, and they used medical experimentation to keep me alive. The side effects were so profound. 4 months after it was done to me, it became illegal to do to humans, because the side effects were birth defects, sterility, dwarfism, and dead by 20 guaranteed. At age six, I added rheumatoid arthritis to it, and I've lived in chronic pain by the rest of my life.
So this journey's been a long journey of pain and it's like strife.
Were those
So
kids in school and
that
bullied all the time?
I was bullied because I'm small, like I'm like 5 feet tall, so I
Well,
get that bullying aspect. I got it all through school from kindergarten to grade 12, like every day.
they
That's
stopped
what.
in grade 12.
Yeah, it stopped. It didn't really, because I live in a small town. So, the people that dislike me still will scream things at me if they see me, and I'm 37 years old. So this is a 20-year grudge for no reason, bullying. But that's what led
Well,
to my addiction. But I'll let you continue. Sorry.
so the problem was that because of all of it, I wanted desperately to belong, to be like everybody else. But I did, gosh, I was wearing the same clothes in kindergarten and fourth grade.
That's like I can wear children's clothing now, so I understand that.
And so I couldn't do sports because I medically couldn't. And so I didn't fit in. So I tried so hard to fit in that I hid my birth defects and my pain. And when the kids jumped off the swing set, so would I, even though when I hit the ground, it was like electricity shooting through my entire body to my neck. But I'd get up and do it again because I wanted to be cool. And but the problem is, as you get older, cool hurts worse. And you can't belong to cool because you can't keep up. And I graduated at 16 and got a complete handicap scholarship and went to University of Detroit for about a year and a half. But they covered scholarship, but they didn't cover gas and food and stuff. So I had to work a full-time job along with going to college full-time to be able to pay for food, gas, all that stuff.
You would think
And
that they would give you like, because I just know from my school funding that I get funding because I have children. So they give me the tuition plus a bit extra to survive off of. You would think I have accessibility, which is not quite disability through the school, but it's because of mental health, not physical health. So it's accessibility. But you would think. Then that's why I get a little bit of extra money. You'd think that they would do the same for somebody who had a physical
if
issues
you if,
too.
yeah if you lived in 1970,
Yeah.
the rules were different. I got the first handicapped parking space in the University of Detroit's history.
That's something I would be proud of. I'd be like, I have this.
Yeah, so they put it on cardboard and I had to tape it to a window and hope the sweat from the cold didn't wash it away again. That's how it archaic it was.
Not to laugh, but I'm just like, oh my goodness.
It's just crappy.
Yeah.
But I wasn't complaining because I was the first kid in my whole family's generation to go to college. So I couldn't not go. I couldn't fail because my family was counting on me to be this ordinary kid. My sister died of polio at age four, right before the vaccine came out. And I was the makeup baby, and my mom had had a nervous breakdown over the loss of my sister. So when I was dying at birth, she grabbed the doctor, says, "If he dies, you die." So that's how they put me in the experiment. And the challenge was that all the way through, my mom expected me to be normal. And I was ADDHD before they had letters for it. I was the high-strung child who couldn't sit still, who looked around the room, who talked to everybody, who, because I couldn't stop myself. It was who I was. I got paddled for it. I got grounded for it. I got all kinds of things for it except encouragement.
Because like
And
you said,
so,
your mom wanted the perfect like jock, son, right? And it's not fair.
they got the little
Yeah,
nerd.
but it's just not fair to you. But I mean, I know what like that must have felt like, because my husband, his mom lost two children before him and had a nervous breakdown, and he lived with his grandma until he was seven because she was. And even now, she's so hyper about anybody getting sick about anything that she couldn't handle parenting him at the time because she was so
He was too
like
fragile.
she was yeah she was so she just couldn't like handle like carrying him and being afraid she would cough anything. So his grandma took him till he was seven, and his mom was had some time to heal from all of her trauma. But I know from that happening, she still expected a lot out of him to be normal too, right? And he was the heavy metal, dyer hair black kind of kid. So it spent a lot of time.
If I had done that, my mother would have crucified me on the spot. There would have been no chance.
Oh, he.
I was raised super strict. I mean, we're talking, tell a lie and you get spanked. I
Yeah.
don't mean spanked, I mean whooped.
Oh yeah, my mom we used to get beat with an airplane fan belt because my grandfather was military, so I know like from
So yeah,
her.
you understand.
Yeah.
So being the littlest kid in the school, having all these other problems. It was a hard growing up. It was just rough. In eighth grade, I was 3 foot 1.
I think I probably was too, but I just genetically am small.
Well, I would have been taller, but the experiment, they didn't expect me to even get to be 3 foot. They told me I would
What?
be
Did
probably,
they
because
say like,
dwarfism was one of the problems that came out of the birth defects.
well, what
The
is like, what is the medical, did they tell you like the medical term for the surgery they gave you as a baby to save you?
hyper ex radiation exposure.
Okay, so they exposed you to a
In the
lot of
days
radiation.
they were doing X-rays, in those days, the smallest he head was the size of a small dinner plate.
Yeah.
At 1 day old, they laid it here. And they shot as much radiation through it as they now use on an elephant to go through to get the other hip. So where you have glands, I have jerky.
Yeah.
And the side effects of that is that your body doesn't produce what it needs to produce. Your pituitary just sputters out. All the other glands in there they don't function well. Add to that the fact that my mom was an closet alcoholic and bipolar. It was a joyous time to be growing up.
Oh, I bet. I lived in, my mom was the same with the closeted alcoholism aspect and the expectations of I needed to be perfect. I'm an only child. She couldn't have any more, and I had a lot of pressure put on me, and then I had the bullying too because I was the smallest kid, so I can relate to a
You
lot
were
of
the little
that.
princess and you couldn't live up to it.
Yeah, I know my mom made me, she, like, I you have homework, then she would make her own homework and make me do that for an extra hour after school and stand over me and yell at me while I'm doing it.
I
And
understand.
then you'd ask her for a sip of her water that she'd put in an orange water bottle so you couldn't see in it. And I'd be like, oh, mom, can I have a sip of your water? No. If you wanted water, you should have brought your own because she was drinking wine out of that water bottle. So she was trying to, yelling at me, no, you can't have this water. You should have brought your own if you wanted it, kind of because it's closet drinking.
Well, she did, wasn't drinking heavily till, gosh, junior high school, And
Same, yeah.
a doctor told her that if she drank wine, it would help her with her arthritis, because we are multi-generational. Every kid, every grandkid, every niece and every nephew have arthritis. None of the cousins, everybody got it. All their kids got it. All three of my kids got it. I don't know how many of the nine grandkids have it or not, but some of them do already, we can tell. So the short of it is that with that in the background, my mom understood that wine was okay. And her brother worked at a warehouse that sold beer and wine. So my dad is an accountant. He could get gallons of wine cheaper, and he could get small bottles of wine. So he began to bring 4 gallons at a time home. And my mom was self-medicating herself to the point where she was sloshy.
Well, that's kind of what happened to my mom. She had a when I was younger, she wasn't like when she was doing the homework and the you have to be the best at any sport you try and you have to have the perfect report card. When she was like that, she wasn't drinking, but she had a fam like a severe family thing happened that I can understand from the trauma of this family thing that happened to her, where well I guess I'll kind of explain it. She'd been told her whole life that her mother had passed away, and when I was about 14, these people come and say, "No, we're your brothers and sisters. Your mother never passed away, and your father, it says on our birth certificates, is our father too." So it was a big, blew up the family kind of thing.
I
And
guess.
she turned to drinking to cope with how it affected her within her family and even within herself. I think because she thought at least I wasn't abandoned by my mother. She passed away. But no, I was abandoned by my mother. She had more kids. Are these kids related to me or like full blood or are they?
Yeah. How do I fit into this new mess?
Yeah, so it was a whole thing, and it's just led to now. She just hasn't been able to shake it since then, I think, and it's gotten worse over the years. And you know how it is when you're not. She was raised military, so she's not supposed to have feelings, right? So instead of having feelings, she'll have a glass of wine. That's kind of how she
Yeah,
works.
I understand. So the short with me was that a year and a half into college, going to 100, let's see, I was working 40 hours, 30 to 40 hours a week. I had 21 hours of school. I had 120 hours of lab time, and a year and a half in, I had a nervous breakdown in the student union. I melted down. I had
A
nothing
lot.
left to give.
That's
I mean,
burnout. Yeah.
I was past burnout. I was meltout. The kids who sat around me scooped me up and took me to the student counseling, and the guy that was the counselor was actually had a double doctorate in psychology. And he sat me down and explained what was happening to me. He arranged for the college to freeze my scholarship for up to 10 years and said, go home, get well, come back. We're ready for you. Unfortunately, all I heard in my now depressed, overwhelmed state is, I'm a failure. I screwed this up and you don't want me. That's what I heard. Now, I'm not saying that's what my ears heard. But that's what the that was running in my head. So, from there, I was working in a men's club. Too serious. So let's take you out drinking, and that's when things got bad. Is when that happened. They took me to a bar, told me to relax and have fun. And I had my first drink. 4 months later, I could drink most of them under the table.
And it's funny
I
because
was.
we're both small. I was an alcoholic for a while, and people, it's the same thing because you and I are both so small. People don't expect it from us, and then you're like drinking them under the table, and they're like,
They all fired me. They didn't want me as a friend because I was a drunk all of a sudden. I went from their friend to this crazy drunk guy. And
that's awful.
that rejection didn't help.
Nope.
And so over a period of the next couple of years, It went down and down and down and down. And I worked three jobs so I could afford the alcohol. I lived in my parents' basement in a makeshift bedroom, and up in the rafters, I had alcohol hidden and all, and pints of scotch hidden all over the upstairs, up in the rafters. And so if I could, I didn't. When I wasn't working, I was drinking. When I was working, I was trying not to them for them to find out I was drinking. But the three jobs was so when I get fired from being drunk, I could still afford my alcohol.
I know that feeling. And I actually worked at as a bartender so that if I came in hungover smelling like alcohol, I could use the excuse I'm working with alcohol so that they couldn't
Yeah, well,
like
I
tell.
tried that too. I got a long story I won't tell you today, but another time I will. I ended up working as a bartender in a restaurant where I was training for assistant manager at a steakhouse, and it was owned by the mafia.
Oh no, so they've got lots of options for you, not just
Yes,
alcohol.
and so I will gleefully tell you that story in the next visit.
Sounds
Because
good.
it's worth the story, but just we only have so many minutes. But the short of it is that the pain got worse, physically worse, and I couldn't. I was to the point where I would the car that my dad had given me was a stick, and I was having trouble with the clutch, the spring hurting me so bad that my leg would drop, and I rear-ended somebody twice. Waiting at a light because my leg just went blunk and bang, bang. And it was, I didn't do it. It just happened because I couldn't do it. And slowly but surely I got to the point, what's the use? And the voice in my head started saying, the only way out is dead. And so I overdosed four times. I took enough each time to kill several people, but God kept me alive in spite of myself.
There's divine interventions for a reason. I believe in that 100%.
Well, let me keep going before I get sidetracked, because I will get sidetracked. I'm guilty of that for sure.
Do so, yeah.
So what happened is that the fourth time was on the day before Christmas. I had worked a full day and hadn't eaten a thing. Got some guys in the car. You don't know, maybe you know what a GIQ is?
Like a car?
It's a giant quart of beer.
Oh, okay. We call them ghetto 40s.
Well, in my days they were GIQs. They were about this big around, about this
Yeah.
tall. And so we got 20 of those in our car to the four guys. And we went cruising.
Back then, it wasn't illegal to drink and drive, was it?
Well, if you got caught, but who
Well,
was
my
looking?
mom said that they would slap you on the wrist and take you home if you
Well,
got
depends how
caught.
bad you
Yeah,
were.
she said,
It depended how bad you were. It was measured. And who you
yeah.
knew, and who
Well,
you knew. If
she
you're
grew up in.
related to somebody, you can get away with anything. I wasn't related to anybody, so I got nailed for everything. But that's
Oh,
another
okay.
story.
She was in
That
the military. Like, her dad was a
so
military officer.
back to the story, so I
Getting
don't get
slapped.
lost, because I will
Yeah.
do it. So I drove the car at 100 miles an hour off a bridge into what should have been a river, except because of the freezing. The water hadn't it went away, and all there was mud and a big tree this big around. I hit that tree and ripped it out by the roots, slid through the mud and stuck. The guys evaporated instantly. They didn't even they would they would never look me in the eye ever again. They were gone. I lost them as friends. I even lost where they went. They were gone.
You had a
And I
lot of people
called.
that just like threw you away. Like, that's
Oh
horrible.
yeah. So I crawled through the mud, got out, and went to the nearest house, banged down the door, knocked on the door and begged, my car's been in an accident. You're drunk, aren't you? Oh, I'm past that. And I need a tow truck. How much money you got? I got $40. Well, I won't pay for a tow truck. Well, call him, I'll beg. So the tow truck guy came out and gave me the lecture of the century, dragged my car out of the mud. It was an old Dodge Dart, and it had a real stainless steel heavy-duty chrome bumper. I bent it like a so it looked like it smiled now. And I drove that critter home. And in my mind, I was hearing stupid, 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 stupid. You can't even kill yourself, stupid. And I began the plan to buy the rifle to finish the job. I was working at one of my jobs, which at carving candles at a in a commune hippie mutual store setting, and I was carving hippie candles. So I was carving blood, skulls dripping blood and brains melting and all that stuff. And I couldn't make them fast enough because the people, they were so gory, people were buying them before the wax dried.
That they sound
And
really interesting, actually.
well, we can talk about that in another time.
Yeah, I won't
But
sidetrack you, but yeah.
the short of it is that this girl came in to talk about Jesus while I'm carving, and I'm saying, I'm busy right now, excuse me. And she's saying, no, I'm staying. We're gonna talk. And after about 45 minutes of her sanding me down with her questions, I finally said, what do I need to do to get rid of you? And she said, well, you need to come to church with me. And I went, church? I've never been to church. I don't know about that. And she looked down and saw that I drew a lot. And these were not just regular, these are morbid pictures. These were graveyards with gnarling trees that look like hands holding skulls, dripping blood, and evil eyes. They're, I mean, really, really demonic stuff.
My husband, yep.
My name's on every gravestone. And when she looked at it, she realized that this was on a Tuesday, and I had Saturday on every gravestone. She said, explain yourself. And I said, it's easy. This world sucks. I can't take the pain. So I get the gun on Friday night and I blow my brains out on Saturday. This world doesn't deserve living and I'm done. So she would not give up on me till I went to church with her. I was way out of her league of trying to share. She still had her spiritual training wheels on, and I was, the emergency room guy. I was tore up too bad for her, even know what to do with. So she brought me to church. The church people did not like the fact that this little 83-pound guy with the 18-inch afro, it had been scooped into the church drunk and stoned. And they talked about me
Those are
openly.
the people that need it the most. That's the problem. Because I had a friend that went to church, same judgment, and it's
Yeah.
like he needs it the most.
So I leaned over to her and I says, I'm in the wrong place. She said, no, they're in the wrong place. This is a house of hope. You're in the right place. Let's go. And I couldn't argue, I couldn't walk. So she scooped me up, put me in a pew, and they started singing. And I love to sing. So I got out the songbook and I could read music. So I sang along. No idea what they were singing. Had no idea what the words meant, but I was singing. And then the young guy who was preaching was about my age. But as he's preaching, all of a sudden, this is an old one-room schoolhouse with hardwood floors that's now a chapel. And I'm shaking so bad from it that the floor is going bump, 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 bump. And these people in the back that didn't want me there going, shh, like I was doing it on purpose. So, I turned to her and says, I still in the wrong place. Nope, just we're in the right spot. So finally he says, with every eye closed, no one looking around, if you need Jesus, raise your hand. And she heard me say, do I, don't I? I don't know what I want, but my hand went up. And when I realized it was up, I was terrified of them and I tried to pull it down. And it wouldn't go down. And I just knew they were going to come jump me. I've been jumped enough times to know what it felt like. So finally he said, thank you, brother. See that? And I pulled it down and sat on it like I was going to hatch it. And he finally says, you need Jesus and you're not ashamed of anybody. Come forward. Well, I looked at the front. There he was. But right to his right was the emergency exit. And I figured I was sober enough now that I could cut around him and go out the door and get in the car and go home. I got up, I went to the front, and this great big guy, 6 foot something, and I'm guessing 6'5", probably about 280, hopped over the pulpit in this tiny little chapel. And he's standing in front of me and he says, can I show you something? I said, sure, just don't hit me. And he showed me where the scripture says, for whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And I said, so what does that to mean? He looks me in the eye and says, God knows about your birth defects. He knows about your arthritis. He knows how much pain you're in. He knows about your hemorrhaging ulcer that's bleeding out of both ends. He knows that you've been trying to kill yourself over and over and over again. No one in the room knew any of this. No one, not even the girl that brought me, knew all this. And I said, so what do I do with that? He says, you go to the altar over there and kneel down and cry out to the Lord. Well, the only other people at the altar on the other side were two guys that were converted hippies, long hair, bib overalls with roosters on them, still looking like stoners, but they're clear. And they were going, thank you, Jesus. Yeah, really loud screaming. So having never been to church, I thought that's how you prayed. So I screamed, Jesus, if you're real, I give you 6 months to prove yourself. If you are, I'll serve you with the rest of my life. And if not, I know where the gun is. And suddenly I was sober. I hadn't been sober in 3 years. And I was as clear as I was when I was born sober. If that didn't scare me, the next part was I felt this need to ask for forgiveness. Now, understand, nobody's telling me to do anything. But all of a sudden, I felt like this balloon ready to explode, and someone released the neck, and all this stuff had to come out. So I began to say, Lord, forgive me for this and this and this. And it's times, days, and places of stuff I did wrong. Bad things I did to girls, all that horrible stuff. They cleared the chapel. They didn't want their kids hearing that stuff. By the time I was empty, I felt like a balloon that went flat. I had nothing left.
Yeah.
My 18-inch afro was just a soggy mess. Looked like a poodle's mess. And I'm laying on the floor just, thank you, Jesus. And all of a sudden, I hear a voice. And I like look around, and there's no one even near me. And it says, my son, David, I have called you with an everlasting love, and I've called you to preach my word. If you'll love my people and preach my word, I will change lives. If you'll love my people, then preach my word, I'll change hundreds of thousands of lives. Will you love? Yes. Will you preach? If you show me how, yes. And the voice was gone, and I was clean, and I was forgiven, and I belonged, and I didn't have to do anything to be impressed, or I didn't have to perform ever again.
You didn't have to try to be cool, almost like you like in school and
well,
stuff.
Yeah, I was pretending very well for years, and all of a sudden I was clean. So those two guys came over and scooped me up and became my private AA. And they said, "Let's go in the back and get cake." They're saying, the guy's leaving for going to his new church, and they got cake and ice cream. Let's go get some cake. So I couldn't argue. I couldn't walk. So they scooped me up and brought me in the back, and there was about 40 people back there, and about 20 of them were thrilled, hugging me, congratulating me, encouraging me. And the other 20 were like, oh my God, that's going to get near our children.
But those people are the people that aren't, I, those are the people that aren't really fully.
Those are the ones who wreck it for church.
Yes. They're the ones that aren't seeing what Christ is really about, in my opinion.
That's why they call them, that they were like whitewashed sepulchers or graves, clean on the outside and filthy on the inside. When you don't love, you're filthy inside. Just that simple. And so as they taught me how to live for Jesus, my pastor began to teach me what it was like to be an evangelist, because I knew that's what I was supposed to do. And we started with children's ministry. And eventually I did that well enough that I began to get people who did more creative arts things. My background in high school and college was theater. So I was looking for performance ways to do it. I wanted to get the kids to pay attention. If somebody had told me when I was a little kid about Jesus, much of the hell I went through would have never happened. But at 20, I didn't want other children to get to be 20 and not know who Jesus was. I didn't care about the building or the denomination or the flavor or whether you sit, stand, kneel, genuflect or any of that. I wanted him to feel that love. I wanted him to feel accepted. So I had people mentor me in gospel magic, which is object lessons using professional paraphernalia. No spiritualness to it at all, just gadgets. Storytelling, balloon animals. Ventriloquism, and then eventually clowning. And then I was mentored by a professional clown and got good enough that I went to my first clown convention and found out from two Ringling Brothers clowns that were there that I was on my way to being master quality, which is as good as you can get.
Yeah.
By the next time I went to a convention, they sat me down and said, "You are now a master clown. Ringling doesn't tell us. We are the masters. We tell you when you've achieved, and you've achieved. You're the first Christian master clown in America." And I'm
That's
going,
definitely.
I mean, I had no clue. I was doing this for the children. I wasn't doing this, but I had this really heartbreak that these kids were going to get leftover recycles instead of quality stuff. So I spent my life being that good. We ended up creating the Kids Celebration Circus, Heavenly Good Clean Fun, and I toured for 12 years doing that internationally.
That is so cool. And the funny part about it is, I've actually talked to somebody else while doing the podcast that actually was in the circus he himself, and he said he trained the horses for the circus, and
I'd love to meet him.
his name's Dave Letterfly. He actually lives in an RV and travels around and does custom paint work for motorcycles. But yeah, he started off in the circus himself, and it's just interesting because I don't know a lot of people who worked in the circus.
So the short of it is, I know we're running out of time, and I don't want to short you. After a life of 50 years of ministry, I have done more things than most people ever dream for a guy that was supposed to be dead at 20. I was sterile. I have three children, nine grandchildren. I'm 74, and I'm still clicking along for the Lord. And
That's cool.
I still have addictive potential. I can still get addicted to stupid. I just have to always be on my guard. If the people say, "Are you delivered?" Oh, I'm delivered from drink, but I'm not delivered from addiction. I
Addiction can
still
come in
have
any
to live.
form.
I still have to live a holy and careful life, or otherwise I'm going to get sucked into somebody's vacuum somewhere. So I wrote my book before I got too old to do it. And it's called When the Doctors Say No, God Says Yes.
I like that title. That's so good for especially your specific story.
And it's on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. So I did all right to get on both of those platforms
Oh yeah.
for a first book.
Well, look at your story just from just the small little bit of it that you've told me is very very captivating, and I think that people can relate to all kinds of different parts of the story. You know what I mean? Like, it's a little bit of something for everybody just from your own life.
And I would be honored to come back and give you another chapter of it anytime. I'm thrilled that you gave me this chance to share God's love.
I've experienced it myself, and like my daughter go I don't go to church because my son won't sit through it, and refuses to he just I don't go with my daughter. She goes with her grandmother. It's something she loves. She absolutely loves it, and I promote anything like that because obviously in my experience with addiction I've had to find my higher power, which is God, and find my way. I've had miracles happen to me that shouldn't have happened to me because of prayer, and
Oh, yeah.
I have my belief in rooted in faith as well. So, I mean, it's a no-brainer to talk to somebody that I can kind of relate to. It's more when somebody is agnostic that I talk to, it's hard for me not to say things about God. So it's a little bit opposite.
Yeah, well, with me, my answer to people who don't believe is, this is my story. I'm not asking you to live my story. I'm not going to shove my story on you, but as I respect your story, will you respect mine?
That's a good way to go about it, because I do have
And
people that give me pushback.
it has done me well internationally. I've been in 49 states and 20 countries. So God did something right, and it's not me, it's him. But I'm honored to have the chance to tell my story, because that's what changes lives, is the story you live. And God tells us to tell our story.
That's what I just was talking to the last person I interviewed, and he said to me that it's not his story to tell. Like, it's not his story to tell, like, keep to himself. It's his story to share. God gave him that story and saved his life so that he could share and help others.
Exactly. Exactly. You've got it right between the eyes. You've exactly got it. And I'm grateful for your sensitivity to this. I really am. I'm grateful to have you as a friend.
Same here, and I will say you have some very nice eyes, so I can see how you managed to have three kids.
Thank you. My wife thinks so too. We've been married 51 years now. So I'm 51 years married, and she hasn't killed me in my sleep, so I'm still doing something right.
My husband would say the same thing. She hasn't killed me in my sleep yet.
But I am grateful for this chance, and anything we can do to be a blessing or a help, let me know. My
What's your
website,
website, actually, before we get any
I am
further?
an award-winning landscape photographer. My website is my name, DavidWEibel.com. So the common spelling, DAVID, middle initial W. Last name is EBEL. And if you just put DavidWEibel.com, it'll come right up for you. And in the drop downs, it talks about my book, a little bit about my story. And I just added a new drop down called podcasts. And this podcast will be listed among them.
Well, I'll send you also the full recording so that you can do what you want with it. I also do clips as a bit of a preview to people. So
We
I'll send you, I usually send people the clips and the interview, and then they can do what they want to do with it too, because I like to let people have their own, it's their interview, it's not my interview. So you do what you want to do with it, you know?
If you look closer, you get a hug.
Yeah.
But thank you for your time and making time for me.
Well, thank you for the same thing.
You're awesome.
So are you. Incredible, actually.
Well,
Survivor.
now you got to read the book so you can understand the rest of the story.
I definitely will be I actually have some free Amazon points. I might buy the book with my free Amazon points so I can read it over the holidays.
The offer I always give is you buy a paperback or a hardbound, send it to me and I'll autograph it for you. If you get the electronic version, I can't autograph electronics. So,
Well,
you know.
I'm old school. I don't know how to read on a computer. I need the book. I need to feel the pages in my hands and stuff. I just it's
No,
just I'm not used to reading on a computer anyway, so
I'm
yeah.
frugal. I'm frugal, so when I found out the cost of the paperback and the hardback was only $8, I'm buying the hardback for me because that means it'll last. But everybody's got their nickels and dimes and has to be careful these days. But I have two dreams. One is that people will read the book and be moved. And second, that they'll be moved enough that they'll want to give one to someone else and comfort someone who's struggling.
Like that
Because
lady that came in and grabbed you and forced you to church, right?
she's still a dear friend. She and her husband and my wife and I are dear friends still.
Well, I can
All
only
these years later.
imagine.
Yeah, she was at our wedding and she's been in our lives. Her name is Barbara, and Barbara's been in our lives all those years. And she doesn't even remember the details I remember because it was more important to me than it was to her. She was just thrilled she did her job and brought me to church and God did his work. To me, I began to live the day that happened.
The funny thing about that, it's kind of interesting. She came up and talked to you. My daughter, her father, like, so she goes to church with her father's mother, her grandmother, and she always gets these little Jesuses. And my mother-in-law hands them out, and she's like, "Everybody needs a little Jesus," and she like hands you a little Jesus. And so that's what my daughter does with people. And it's almost kind of like what she did with you, but with actually bringing you to church and giving you a little Jesus in the physical sense, you know?
We have a new art gallery that's just opened in the town I live in, named The Pink Duck.
That's interesting.
And the gal who did it, who opened it, is a world-renowned painter. And in her retirement years, she and her husband opened up a gallery. And she has featured my pictures And my wife makes the old style handmade one of a kind greeting cards, like they used to do in the 30s and
Yeah.
40s.
I love those when I find like when I go through my grandmother's stuff, like her old
Well,
like she my grandmother has been somebody who has what you call scrapbooked from like everything from like my grandfather, I even what he brought home from Japan when he was there in the
yeah,
military, like
I
everything. So I love
understand.
looking at the greeting cards and the postcards
Well,
that my grandpa would send home from wherever he was, and I think that's so cool.
Diane makes those now, and the art, both of our arts are now in display in the museum. In the it's not a museum; it's an it is a full blown place for art, and people. She's got sculptures. She's got all kinds of paintings, but I'm one of the only photographers in the entire building.
Well, I'm looking at your photography behind you. Before we talked, he said that this is some of his photography, so I was just kind of admiring it a little bit.
Well, I'm going to send you one that you can actually have printed and framed.
Well, thank you. So you're so kind.
Well,
Rarely find people this kind. I think thank you.
I think that love is not love until you give it away. I can't get any more until God, I give it away. There's no room for more. If God gives me love, I can't give it to store. I have to give it to someone. I'm still looking for the stranger I haven't met.
I like that saying.
I only know I keep finding people who, if they'll let me, will be my friends. The only people who aren't my friends are the people who won't let me.
You know what? Even though I've done probably about 200 interviews, I have managed to stay in contact with almost every single person because I always learn something or take something away from anyone that I talk to. And I don't know, it's a way to make friends in a way that I can relate to that. Do you know what I mean? So
Well, we've begun something good.
I definitely agree, and I definitely will have you on probably over and over and over again because you're so
Well,
interesting.
I would love to be a repeat guest. You would not hurt my feelings by having me back.
Because I definitely there's some stories in there that we obviously didn't have time to touch on that I would love to share with some like with the people that watch this because this going from making those because I have a friend who makes resin skulls, so I was picturing that. So from going from doing like that kind of artistry to church, it's an interesting ride along the way, and then how it happened, and then you know what I mean, how you grew from there and growing up. I know that that couldn't have been easy by any measure. So, I mean, you're definitely a survivor, like one of the biggest survivors I've met out there. I'm like having those trials and tribulations as a child, and you can't do anything about it. And then still working three jobs and working your butt off as hard as you can. And even though you are going through some very hard mental times, to finding God and being able to let go of the things that were keeping you trapped, it's such a beautiful journey, really.
Well, and you got the Reader's Digest version. There's more to tell.
Well, before I let you go, is there anything that you would like to say before, like to the people watching,
Sure.
any advice or anything?
Let me speak to the heart of anyone that's watching. You are not the sum of your parts. You were created to love. This world can try to beat you up and lie to you and cheat you and convince you that you're nothing. But that can't be true because you were custom one at a time, created by God to love. That's the purpose for why you were made. Therefore, all you need is someone to shine the light to show you that you're not buried in a cavern. There is hope. There is a future. And if what God did for me is available to anyone else, which scripture says it is. What he did for me, he can do for you. You say, well, I've done it before and it didn't work. Let's try again. How many times did I fall off a bicycle before I finally got up and rode? I can't count. How many times did I try everything else before I got it right? uncountable. Many times am I willing to try before so that God can finally show me what I'm supposed to do with the rest of my life? Doesn't matter how many times you try. It takes one trust, one jump off the cliff trust. Okay, God, even if it makes no sense, nothing else makes sense. You make more sense than anything else. I trust you. Here I am. Take me. That's what it'll take to start things. Then surround yourself with people who you want to be like. People who are bigger in their faith and better at what they do than you are, and say, I don't know what to do. Show me. Don't be prideful. Be hungry. And your life will change. I guarantee you it'll change if you want it to. I'm living proof.
There you have it. It's really true, actually. Like, just thinking about the diagnosis you were given, and I actually interviewed somebody else that had been given a cancer diagnosis that he wasn't going to live, like he was going to die within the next few years, and he felt relieved because he's like, well, then I don't have to kill myself because of this, and I can go naturally, and my family will never feel that pain of me killing myself. Then he ended up surviving and basically is kind of has the same outlook on things as you do now, because he would say, God saved me and I wasn't supposed to be here. And now I see things a lot differently than I had before, you
Well,
know?
the doctors have told me the seven times this is it. So I stop listening to the doctors.
Yeah.
I
My
start listening to, I go and I listen and I honor, but Jesus is who is my master.
My
Doctors
stepdad
have,
was supposed to die 10 years ago. Same
doctors
thing.
are honest one way. They call everything they do a practice. They don't call it a profession. And that's good because they'd be lying big time. They're practicing on us. So I listen to them as they practice, and then I go home and pray, and I trust.
That is the best way to think of it, because, like I said, my stepdad was given a diagnosis that he was supposed to die about 10 years ago now, and he's still alive. And we even rushed a wedding of his son, and his birth, like, we did his birthday party early and all that kind of stuff, because we threw a huge party because we thought he was going to not live past 4 months, like we were told. He's here 10 years later, so. There's so many instances where, like you said, it's practice, but it's not perfection. They don't know for sure. So
No.
I
Well,
thank you. I keep word souping you, and then you're word souping me. I'm like, ah, sorry.
thank you. I look forward to more adventures together.
Same here, and I will definitely be back in touch with you because I feel like we just skimmed the surface, and I really just love how you look at life, and I just think that a lot of people will get a lot out of what you have to say because you've been a survivor your whole life. So I think people listen to that more than somebody who hasn't really struggled, and you know what I mean, is just maybe coming from a clinical background, you know, instead of a faith and survivor background. So I really think that a lot more people will resonate with things you have to say than somebody who is just coming out of college as an addictions counselor would maybe have to say. You know what I
Yes,
mean? And
yes.
as bad as
We're friends that are
that
counselors.
sounds.
So there, we could go on for another hour easily, but I do have another appointment.
I will let you go, and we will reconnect very shortly.
Good.
Thank you so much for coming on and talking with me today. I appreciate it. Actually put me in a bit of a better mood, so thank you so much. I
Well,
really
my
enjoyed
honor.
talking to you.
God gets all the glory. Anything good that happened was him. Anything bad that happened is what's left.
Well, thank you so much, and you have a good rest of your day. I
You
appreciate
as
it.
well. God
And
bless you,
yeah,
my friend.
God bless you too, and I won't say goodbye. I'll say I'll talk to you later.
Good. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.